today's programme, which feels quite an uncomfortable role, really, because I'm much more accustomed to being very critical of the scientific approach to health and disease. And also, I'm much more excited by ideas and theories than I am by facts and statistics. But nevertheless, I'm going to talk about some of the research that's been done on the psychology of cancer, the psychology of physical illness generally, and on the mind-body connections, and look a little bit at how we understand mind and body being connected, the philosophical basis of that. And then move on to look at what a holistic health approach to health is all about, what are the general principles, what does it involve, and how is it different from the traditional medical approach, and really what's wrong with medicine today. And I certainly feel, and probably many people here do, that there's a great deal wrong with it. So that's basically what I'm going to say. If you can't hear at the back, please shout, because sometimes I do go quite quiet. So 6 or 7 years ago, a GP phoned me up at the hospital that I was working at the time to say that he had a patient in her early 40s who'd recently had breast cancer. And she was coping just about with the emotional impact of having had cancer. The lump had been removed. She was having chemotherapy and radiotherapy. But she was very keen to understand why she had had cancer. She was convinced that emotional factors had triggered the disease, and she wanted to see a psychologist to work out why it had happened and how she could prevent it recurring. The GP was somewhat bemused by this and was humouring her to some extent, but thought that he would go along with it, and so referred her to me. And I was delighted to receive that kind of referral. And she turned out to be really a very typical cancer-prone personality. So I'll start off by telling you her life story. I'll call her Jennifer. And then go on to look at some of the research and illustrate why she was a typical cancer-prone personality. She was the eldest of three children. She had a younger brother and sister. And she talks about her mother being forever busy. Her mother was always pottering about the kitchen. She was cooking and cleaning, tidying up, caring for the younger brother and sister. And Jennifer always felt pushed out. She was expected to be a little mother to her brother and sister and around the house from about the age of 5 or 6. And she grew up desperately trying to please her mother and always failing, never getting the kind of love and attention that she felt she needed. She was very keen on ballet, and at the age of 13 she remembers entering ballet competition, and she was very excited to have been chosen to enter this competition, and she thought she'd do quite well. And on the evening of the competition, her mother told her that she needed her to stay in because they were going out and they needed a babysitter for her younger brother and sister. And that was the last time she ever danced. Her father was away at sea for long periods, and he always felt like a stranger to her and to the rest of the family when he came home. And she grew up really feeling very much alone. Then at 17 she met her future husband, Robert, who adored her, and for the first time she felt really cared about. Got married, and for the next 15 years really she devoted herself to her husband and their two children. And then just as she was thinking about launching herself into a career, perhaps doing a degree, with the children growing up, her mother had a stroke. Her father by this time was dead, had died some years earlier. And Jennifer was still caught in this trying to please her mother, and so she took her into the family home. And for the next 6 years she spent much of her time caring for this disabled, incontinent, very demanding woman who was extremely ungrateful for Jennifer's care. And then within 6 months her daughter left home to go to university. And her mother had a second stroke and died. And within about 9 months, Jennifer noticed a small lump in her breast. So that's her story. So why was she a typical cancer personality? Let me outline some of the research that's been done on the psychology of cancer. The whole idea that psychological factors are important in cancer is a very old idea. 2nd century AD, the physician Galen noticed that melancholic women were more prone to cancer than cheerful, optimistic women. And going back to 1802, Nunn, talking about breast cancer, said that emotional factors influence the growth of cancer. Looking more at research that's been done, about 50 years ago, a Jungian analyst called Alida Evans studied 100 cancer patients and found that they typically lost an important role or relationship shortly before cancer was diagnosed, and they'd been unable to find some kind of outlet for those emotions. She also suggested that cancer often seems to be related to unresolved problems in the person's life. In the 1950s, David Kisson studied heavy smokers, and he found that the ones who developed lung cancer tended to be very poor at expressing hurt, grief, anger, and resentment. And over the past 20 years, a picture has gradually emerged, a fairly consistent picture of the typical cancer-prone personality. One study suggested that cancer patients tend to have cold, unsatisfying relationships with their parents, and suggested that this makes them very vulnerable to the effects of loss in later life, because they haven't learned how to form close relationships, to communicate their feelings, and they tend to suppress negative feelings. Another study found that people with cancer had more significant, intense emotional events prior to the diagnosis than a control group had. Another study found that high life event scores were able to predict cervical cancer in women who'd had positive smear test results. A study of childhood leukemia found that 31 out of the 33 children had experienced loss or separation in the 2 years prior to the onset of their illness, and mostly in the preceding 6 months. And there was a long-term study in the mid-70s where various psychological tests were given to medical students and were then followed up in later life. And that found that those who later developed cancer reported being much less close to their parents, as did those who later committed suicide or who had mental health problems. A famous set of studies by Stephen Greer at King's College Hospital, looking particularly at women with breast cancer, and that found that women who habitually suppress anger and hostility show raised blood levels of serum 1GA, which plays a crucial role in the immune system, and that a higher level of serum 1GA is associated with a shorter survival time in women who do develop breast cancer. In another study, again, he found that women who strongly suppress anger are more likely to develop cancer in the first place, breast cancer in the first place. Perhaps the most famous study of the cancer personality is by Lawrence Lashan, who's an American psychologist. And he studied 250 cancer patients over a period of 14 years. He interviewed 90 close relatives, and he saw 70 cancer patients in individual psychotherapy. And he found that the profile of the typical cancer patient was something like this, that first of all, they'd suffered emotional disturbance in childhood of some kind, perhaps due to the death of a parent, separation or divorce of parents, or constant friction at home. So childhood for them was a time of frustration, isolation, despair. Often they tried to overcompensate by constantly trying to please others in a kind of plea for love and attention. And as adults, they tended to devote all their energy to their spouse or to a job or to children. They tend to be seen as saints or martyrs or victims by others. They never express anger and resentment. They tend to put other people first. They don't complain about their own problems, typically. And then a crucial role or relationship in their life is lost. Perhaps their husband or wife dies, or they're made redundant, or the children leave home. And because they've never learnt to express grief or hostility, the feelings remain bottled up. And within 2 years of that time, cancer is very often diagnosed. And according to Lishan, about 76% of his cancer patients showed that life pattern, compared with only 10% of a control group who were also attending a cancer clinic, but didn't have cancer. So to test out his theory, he looked at the life history of 28 people whose medical records he was given. 15 of these were cancer patients and 13 were not. And on the basis of just three characteristics, firstly, inability to express hostility, secondly, tension over the death of a parent, and thirdly, loss of a meaning or purpose in life, loss of their raison d'etre, he was able to predict accurately whether or not these people had cancer in 24 out of the 28 cases. If he was choosing randomly, of course, he would have got 14 of them right. He also predicted that since loss seems to be a crucial trigger factor, then cancer mortality would be related to marital status. So he reasoned that widowed people would be most likely to die of cancer, and then divorced people, that married people would be less prone to die, and the single would have the lowest mortality rate from cancer, and the statistics do support that. So all of that then fitted very much with what I learnt from Jennifer, who was the first cancer patient that I saw. And therapy with her involved helping her to express her feelings more openly, helping her to communicate, particularly feelings of grief and anger and resentment and sadness. Secondly, helping her to get her own needs met and to wish for her own needs being met and learning to take care of herself. And there was quite a lot of marital work involved there. And thirdly, to find a new reason for living, to find a meaning or purpose in life, and to somehow see herself as fitting into the structure of the universe, if you like, but to find her place in the universe. And I think what we worked on together was reawakening her sense of life as an adventure, as an exciting journey. And of being able to firstly take some control of that journey, but also being able to go with the flow, and that fitted very much with what was being said this morning. And I think helping her to see cancer as an opportunity rather than as a death sentence. So, what's actually happening here? Why should loss and suppressed emotions be linked with cancer? Well, research has shown that emotions associated with loss, such as hopelessness and despair, sadness, are linked biochemically with sustained rise of, and I'm going to quote lots of long words here that some of you will understand and some of you won't, but living to understand and some of you won't, but they're linked biochemically with sustained rise of hypothalamic pituitary adrenal stimulation, increased secretion of adrenocortical stimulating hormone, and increased plasma corticosteroids, all of which basically means the immune system doesn't function too well when you're experiencing those emotions. And studies have also found that the T cell function, which is a crucial part of the immune system, linked with tissue immunity, which is particularly relevant to cancer, T-cell function is significantly depressed after a bereavement. So there does seem to be a direct link between painful life events and immunosuppression. A recent article in the journal Holistic Medicine suggested that emotional loss in childhood might actually sensitise someone biochemically as well as psychologically to loss in later life. And there are quite a few doctors around who believe that probably most illness is psychosomatic in origin, in other words, triggered by emotional factors and stress. Dr. Ian Pearce, who wrote The Holistic Approach to Cancer, spent about 35 years in general practice, and his belief was, his estimate was from those 35 years, that about 75% of the patients he saw were suffering from psychosomatic disorders, and the remaining 25% from illnesses which was due mainly to lifestyle factors such as diet. Personally, I doubt whether you can separate out those factors in that kind of way, but the notion of type A personalities, people who are competitive, aggressive, always in a hurry, very time-oriented, type A has been linked with coronary heart disease for quite some time, and it's fairly widely accepted that that kind of personality is a factor in coronary heart disease. And a lot of other patterns have been suggested too. Migraine, for example, has been linked with suppressed anger and resentment, low back pain with sexual problems, various skin problems have been linked with suppression of emotions. And certainly I've worked with quite a number of people with skin problems, and I found that those who tend to have the red, angry kind of skin problems tend to be suppressing anger, and those who have the very weepy conditions are suppressing sadness. Sometimes people have both. Not often people have both, but that does seem to be a link. And it's also been suggested that many conditions are symbolic, that if you have neck pain, for example, the question to ask is who's being a pain in the neck, who or what is being a pain in the neck in your life. If you have eye problems, what is it that you don't want to see? If you go slightly deaf, you know, what is it you're not wanting to hear in your life, and so on. And I think that can be a useful way of looking at illness. But we do tend to think of mind and body as quite separate, and this is part of our culture at the moment. Ever since the 16th century and Descartes and Newton, who revolutionised the way we view the world, we've had the concept of the body as a machine and the universe as this great clockwork toy. And those concepts have been quite popular with so-called scientists and lay people alike in recent times. And in a way, it can be reassuring to believe that whatever the problem, whether you've got a car with a burst radiator or a person with clogged arteries, some expert somewhere can, you know, do a quick repair job and put it all right. And that sounds similar to what Don was saying this morning about, you know, if he gets cancer, well, someone will put it right, they'll have a cure by then. So the implication of that is that there's no need to ask ourselves why we're ill. Illness is simply the result of a mechanical breakdown, which the doctor mechanic will sort out for us. And if the drugs or surgery don't work, it's because the technology isn't yet advanced enough. But next month or next year, the new wonder drug might be discovered and everything will be all right. That's a very limited and limiting approach to health and disease. And there's now, thankfully, a movement towards seeing people as much more akin to plants than to machines. And Lawrence Lachan had a book which in this country is called The Holistic Approach to Health, but which in the States was first published as The Mechanic and The Gardener, as two different approaches to health. And one of the analogies that I like is that of organic versus so-called modern farming. You can pour artificial fertilisers and pesticides onto the land and you'll get the crops, but gradually you need more and more chemicals as the soil becomes exhausted and all the natural predators are killed off, and eventually you get soil erosion and you can't use the land at all. Or you can take an alternative approach of nurturing the land, of building up natural sources of fertility with organic manure, allowing natural predators and crop rotation and companion planting and so on to control the pests. And what happens is that the land becomes richer and healthier as the years pass instead of becoming depleted. And that seems to be very similar from the approach of using drugs and treating the body as a machine versus the approach of promoting self-healing and positive health and treating the person as a plant which needs the right kind of environment, the right kind of nourishment to be healthy. And even modern science now, since the turn of the century, is moving away from ideas such as objective reality and that you can find out about things by analysing them into separate parts and putting them under a microscope. In physics, which I'm particularly interested in, relativity theory and quantum mechanics have enormous implications, I think, for the way we view health. They've thrown into question all our old ideas about space and time and matter. And theoretical physicists are now saying, and have been saying for a long time, that the universe is an interacting whole, that you can't separate matter from consciousness or mind. And that the idea of a body as a machine, which could be separated from the whole person it belongs to, simply doesn't fit with our new understanding of the world. And some physicists have also pointed out that 20th century physics looks remarkably like Eastern mysticism and also the beliefs of so-called primitive cultures. And that's a whole topic in itself, but the implication is that mind and body can't be separated, that we should talk about mind-body. So let me illustrate that by going back to some more research and get away from ideas for a while. According to modern theory of disease, people become ill because something's gone wrong with their molecules, basically. Something's gone wrong at the molecular level. Perhaps because we've been invaded by bacteria or viruses, which somehow cause us to be ill. And so you get the so-called explanation when someone has flu or chickenpox, well, there's a lot of it around, you know, so that explains it. But a moment's reflection makes us realise that there may be six people working in the same office and only two of them go down with the flu that's going around. So why were those two vulnerable and why were the four who remained healthy not vulnerable? That seems to me a much more interesting question. Claude Bernard, a medical researcher in the 19th century, wrote, "Illnesses hover constantly about us, their seeds blown by the wind, but they don't settle in the terrain unless the terrain is ready to receive them." And Louis Pasteur's last words, reputedly, were, "Bernard is right, the germ is nothing, the terrain is all." And there's a mass of evidence to support that. I'll quote you a few examples. In about 1900, several scientists drank glasses full of cholera bacilli, which had been isolated from fatal cases of cholera. None of them actually developed cholera. In 1926, in Lübeck, in northern Germany, 249 babies were accidentally injected with massive doses of tuberculosis bacilli. 35% of them did die from acute TB, but 65% survived, and 12 years later they were found to be healthy. And when the bombs fell on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, 2,500 people were less than a mile from ground zero, and they survived, and less than 2% of those developed leukemia. In 1980, the Wall Street Journal reported that over a six-year period, a 1% rise in unemployment is linked with 37,000 deaths. Deaths from all major diseases and causes of death are included in this, including infant mortality, suicide, heart disease, strokes and car accidents. And we also know that widowers have a mortality rate about 3 to 5 times higher than that of married men of the same age. So it does feel as though the whole idea of bacteria and viruses causing illness is such an incomplete explanation of illness that it hardly takes us anywhere along the road to understanding what health and disease are about. So the crucial conclusion, I think, to draw is to remember what Pasteur said, the germ is nothing, the terrain is all, and our focus should be on the terrain, on the whole person that's developing the disease or who is staying healthy despite carcinogens, viruses, bacteria and so on. There has to be something missing or imbalanced about the whole person, the mind, body, spirit, in his or her environment. And I think illness can be seen as an attempt to restore the balance. a lot of psychotherapists are aware that people often seem to develop physical illnesses as an attempt to get certain needs met, and again that was talked about this morning, or to express feelings in an indirect way, to ask for affection indirectly, to punish a neglectful family indirectly, or to escape a boring or stressful job. There are various ways in which illness can be used. We do know that the mind can affect the body in negative ways, in inverted commas, negative. It can make us ill. We all know about the concept of psychosomatic disease, although it tends to be played down. But can it also affect the body in positive ways? That seems a crucial question to ask. I'm talking here as if mind and body were separate things, because that's our customary way of seeing them, but you also have to bear in mind that they're not separate things. So again, I'm just going to pick out a few examples of evidence that the mind can have positive physical effects. First of all, we know that laughter releases endorphins into the bloodstream, the chemicals associated with the suppression of pain and experience of pleasure. And Norman Cousins' famous book, Anatomy of an Illness, showed how important laughter was for him in recovering from a crippling disease. Secondly, if you give people who are in pain placebo pills and tell them that they're painkillers, at least one in three of them will release endorphins into their own bloodstream and experience pain relief. There's a lot of research on meditation and on the benefits of meditation, and it reduces heart rate, blood pressure, blood cholesterol, and a mass of other physiological factors which are associated with reduced stress. And we know that through biofeedback, people can control their blood pressure, they can control body temperature, a lot of factors which are supposedly beyond conscious control. There was one study of subjects in a biofeedback study who had severe tension headaches, and they were asked to keep a diary of the frequency and severity of their headaches before they started biofeedback. And most of the subjects found that as soon as they started the diary, their headaches went away. And that's a well-known phenomenon amongst behaviour therapists as well, who will ask people to record their symptoms of various kinds and find, lo and behold, that they go away. In another study, a group of epileptic children were videotaped with their families. And on several occasions, there were emotionally charged episodes which were frequently followed by seizures. The researchers played back the videos to the children, who made the links between the emotions and the seizures, and then they became almost free of seizures from that time on. Again, I've just picked out a few examples from thousands and thousands that are in the literature, but I think they will make us question our customary views of how mind and body interact. So let me move on to talk a bit about the holistic approach to health and what that means. First of all, I think I want to distinguish between a holistic approach and so-called alternative medicine or complementary medicine, because they don't always mean the same thing. A lot of alternative therapists simply use one technique, such as herbs or massage or whatever, in much the same way that doctors use drugs, I think. They might be a lot safer than drugs, but they don't constitute a holistic approach. For me, I think there are eight features of the holistic approach to health. The first is that it sees the whole person, mind, body, spirit, environment, as one interacting whole, and it treats that whole person at all those different levels. Secondly, it assumes that people have a tremendous capacity for self-healing, and it merely aims to assist or unblock that self-healing process. It doesn't see it as providing something which actually heals the person, just as helping the person to heal themselves. Thirdly, it sees disease, and I like to see that word kind of hyphenated, dis-ease, to remind ourselves that that's what it is, it's the person who is not at ease. It sees disease as a process, not as an entity. One of the ways of illustrating that is, I can't remember where I first read it, but if we talk about a little girl having measles, say, someone who's seeing things from a holistic angle might say little Sarah's measling, and that means something very different from saying Sarah has measles, as though she somehow has this thing which has invaded her. She is measling. Fourthly, it sees symptoms as signs of the body's attempt to heal itself. So it sees symptoms in a positive way. And so suppressing symptoms is seen as counterproductive in general, or even as driving disease deeper into the body. One example of that is, it's widely believed by holistic therapists that if you suppress eczema with steroid drugs, someone is quite likely to develop asthma later on. That seems to be one of the progressions of eczema if it gets suppressed. And similarly, as we said this morning, if you have a fever, it may be part of the body's attempt to heal itself. And if you try and lower someone's temperature with aspirin, you're fighting what the body's trying to do. So the holistic approach has a kind of trust in the body. It doesn't assume that if you've got a symptom, it's a sign of the machine breaking down. It assumes that the body knows how to heal itself and it trusts it. Fifthly, and I think crucially, it sees illness as an opportunity to learn and change. By understanding why you've become ill, you can actually make changes which will promote your own health and wholeness in the future. And the idea of treating the body as treating illness as, you know, a mechanical breakdown doesn't give you that kind of opportunity. Sixth feature, I think, is that there's an emphasis on self-help and on very active involvement and decision-making by the person who's ill, rather than being done to by experts. And that seems very crucial, that sense of being actively involved. Seventh feature, I think, is that there's an emphasis on preventive health care, on the very nature of how you think about health holistically. And the promotion of positive health and well-being. Health isn't just seen as the absence of disease, it's seen as somewhere along a continuum towards being whole as a person. And eighth, and again crucially, everyone is treated as a unique individual. You don't have a program for a particular kind of disease, but you look at that whole person and decide what they need as a unique individual. So if you keep those eight features in your mind, let's take a step backwards now and look at what happens at the moment within medicine. The biomedical model dominates the NHS today. And let me give you a nice quote from Lawrence Lechan. A number of years ago, I went on rounds with one of the outstanding neurologists in the world. A group of us, men and women, some in white clothes, some dressed as civilians, went from bed to bed in the wards while the neurologist examined each patient, read from the chart and described the medical situation to the group. He did not address any of the patients. One patient was a man in his late 70s. With the group crowding around the bed, the neurologist pulled down the sheets, pulled up the man's hospital gown, exposing his genital area, and pointing to his groin and abdomen, made some comments. After a few moments, the patient, obviously embarrassed, started to pull his gown down. Without pausing in his talk, the doctor pushed his hand away and the gown back up. This expert and experienced neurologist, seeing the patient as a machine, clearly had no idea that he was lowering the patient's ability to fight his illness and to bring his own self-healing abilities to the aid of the medical treatment. A motor works just as well whether you pat it on it or spit on it. A person does not, but the doctor was clearly not aware of this. One patient stated very well her feelings about the mechanical attitude of her physician. An angiogram had been prescribed. In this procedure, a long thin tube is inserted into an artery in the arm and carefully pushed up the artery until the end of it is inside the heart, and the heart and the coronary arteries can be dyed and photographed. When this procedure was described to the patient, she felt, even as you and I would, some anxiety, and expressed a desire to meet and talk with the specialist who would perform the actual work. Her cardiologist said, "You don't have to know the person who does this. We're all good technicians here." The patient answered, "But I'm not an automobile." And going back to Jennifer, the first cancer patient I saw, in about the third or fourth session, she said to me, "Since I've been coming here, I've realised that you're the first person in months who's actually treated me as a person, rather than as a cancer patient." And she said that that was one of the most healing experiences for her, that I just talked to her as her, and the fact she had cancer was neither here nor there in many ways. But even her family had been treating her as a cancer patient. There has been a battle for centuries between the naturopathic approach, which focuses on self-healing and individuality, and the allopathic approach, which focuses on active intervention and looking at the body as a machine in various ways. And really, for the past 100 years, the allopathic approach has won, but I think the tide is turning. Let me list just some of the problems with the biomedical model. Firstly, it focuses on illness and not on health. So the question of why some people remain healthy is ignored. A good example of that is with all the research on AIDS. They're peering down all these microscopes at molecules, and they're not asking, why do some carriers of AIDS remain well? That seems to be a much more interesting question than what's happening with these molecules and looking for cures. Secondly, people get fragmented into bits, and so you have kidney units, you have ears, nose and throat specialists, you have heart specialists, you have psychologists. And so you lose sight of the whole person and the connection between all their different symptoms and diseases. And I'm often aware, as a therapist, that someone will mention a physical illness that they had perhaps 2 or 3 years ago, and they might not mention that to me because I'm a psychologist, but once they do mention it, I can use that and say, well, let's look at what that was about. But because people get partitioned off into little bits, you know, they take their heart problems to a heart specialist, they take their psychological problems to a psychologist, and you lose sight of the whole pattern. Thirdly, there is this focus on molecules and microscopes, rather than on people, patterns in health and disease. Microscopes could never have told us that people in social classes 4 and 5 have much poorer health than people in social classes 1 and 2. Or that a low-fibre diet is linked with bowel cancer. You need a completely different set of research questions in order to find out that kind of information. Fourth, it sees symptoms as the enemy. It's a sign of the machine having become faulty, and I think that's a very disrespectful approach to the mind-body system. Fifth, it more or less ignores self-healing. The placebo effect is seen as a complication for research, which I find quite bizarre. But it's seen as in some ways rather a nuisance, that people can heal themselves, even though that's all that happens if people get well, they heal themselves. But there's always this focus on cure and on technology rather than on care and healing. The biomedical model more or less ignores the role of psychological and environmental factors in disease, despite all the research evidence. And it never asks the question why people become ill. The biochemical change is seen as the cause, which is very circular thinking. So it deprives people of this opportunity to learn and grow or to understand the functions of their illness and get those needs met in other ways. I was once in hospital, only once in my life have I been in hospital with pneumonia, and it was thought that something else may be wrong. The doctor came in to me at one point and said that he thought I might have an overactive thyroid. And I remember asking him, what causes that? And he said, the thyroid's producing too much thyroxine. I said, no, what causes that? And he repeated again, I might have an overactive thyroid. He just didn't understand, he didn't hear the question, because his model was that it's the biochemistry, you know, the biochemistry answers all questions. So drugs and surgery basically are seen as the answer to illness, and yet the nation's health clearly isn't improving at all. The myth is that modern medicine has wiped out infectious diseases such as TB and typhoid and so on. The statistics actually show that it was changes in sanitation and housing and hygiene which were more or less wiping out TB and cholera and so on before antibiotics were introduced, and the antibiotics hardly made a blip in the rapid decline of these diseases. And yet we still have this belief, certainly I had the belief until I read Ivan Illich's book, Medical Nemesis, that that modern medicine had done some wonderful things. I'm now very sceptical whether it has done anything wonderful. If we look at cancer, the survival rate for 90% of cancers, the major forms of cancers, has hardly changed in the past 25 years. And what's more people are killed by drug-induced disease than are killed on the roads each year. It's estimated that one in five people admitted to hospital acquire a disease which is induced by the treatment that they have, and one in 30 people die of the treatment. In Britain at this very moment, over 1 million people are suffering from drug-induced diseases. So what happens to the Hippocratic dictum, at least do no harm? It's no wonder that doctors don't swear that anymore, because there is no way you can practice modern medicine and stick to the at least do no harm dictum. So I think in ages past, medicine may have done little good, but it also did little harm. Today, there's a good argument, I think, that it's doing little good and a great deal of harm. So let me finish off with just saying a few more things about holistic healthcare. I think there are signs of hope. The British Holistic Medical Association was founded, I think, about 10 years ago now. And there are a lot of signs of change and of disquiet with modern medicine. Holistic healthcare is oriented towards health rather than disease. It sees disease as a result of imbalance. It looks for sources of imbalance within that whole person, unique person, and asks some questions about what that imbalance might be about. Just wondering whether to miss something out here, or do you want me to finish in 5 minutes?
And then I think there'll be quite a few questions. So.
Right, okay. Okay, let me list that bit out. I think the question is always, in the words of George Engels, why does this patient have this disease now? That's the crucial question to start with. Which parts of the person aren't being nurtured? Which parts are being suppressed? How have things got blocked in their life journey? What's wrong in his or her environment? How can the imbalance be corrected? In other words, how can you promote self-healing and positive health and growth in that unique individual? Modern medicine doesn't ask any of those questions. And I think that's why it's going down this blind alley of chemicals and technology, instead of learning how to care for whole people and helping us to heal ourselves. Right, I'll stop there. I'll just say that there's a handout here on the psychology of cancer, a paper I wrote a few years ago now. Also, I've only got one copy, but there's a reading list of some books which I think are really great, that have influenced me on holistic approach to health. So if people want to just come and look at that, I'm sorry there's only one copy. Right, I should
open up to questions. I've got a few in my head, but I'm going to hang on to it and give that one else a chance.
Well, one question that's bothered me for a long time is, and maybe you have some kind of answer for it, is why, with the tremendous weight of evidence in favor, one, of a psychosomatic central core to most illness, and so much good historical evidence on the need to deal with things holistically, is there such a block, not only in the medical profession, but in the population as a whole, how have we all got so brainwashed? And what value has there been in it that's kept it that way?
Yes. I mean, I think it comes down to this Cartesian-Newtonian way of viewing the world that we've got stuck with. But I think the two main advantages I see, and part of the reason why we've got stuck, is that on the professional side, there's a great deal of status that goes with feeling that you can cure people, and that, you know, having the technology, having all this jargon and expertise and so on. And so we kind of hand that over to the professionals. And on the other side, for patients, you know, when you're ill, there can be something nice about the child taking over and saying, you know, take care of me, you know, of thinking you just have to swallow pills and you'll be all right, rather than thinking you might actually have to help yourself, you might have to really look at your life very carefully, and you might have to do some very difficult stuff about looking at your emotions, your relationships, your lifestyle, and finding out what's wrong. It's much easier to swallow pills. So I think because there's a lot of advantages for professionals in sticking to the kind of parent role, and for patients in sticking to the child role, that we get stuck in that instead of engaging in an adult-to-adult interaction, which is what we have to move towards.
I've got a question which is about being aware of all the things that you're saying, but at the same time still trying to operate in a system. And actually getting to survive as, say, a practitioner,
yes,
operating in that. And I mean, I think talking to a lot of people here at lunch, they were saying, yes, I know this, and I recognise that. How can we help ourselves in that way? What can you do? Big question, I know.
Yes.
It's about self-care. So.
Yes. I mean, I constantly find myself doing a double think at work. You know, there's the part of me that's the kind of orthodoxly trained psychologist and that goes along that line, and there's the other bit of me that thinks completely differently. And trying to integrate those two is very difficult. And I think you just have to do it in little steps of, you know, just making comments at meetings that imply slightly different models, doing slightly different things with clients, taking a few risks. Mm. I don't think I have any easy answers to that.
Mm.
I think it's a massive question. Yeah.
I think as a whole, mankind is growing up. Mm. The whole of humanity seems to be growing up, but we're not afraid to ask questions anymore. And it's not so much a question of don't do as I do as I say, which as a little girl my mother and father would say that. And it's a little bit like the church. You know, the church was the hierarchy, and there was the father figure telling you what you could and could not do. But that's not good enough anymore, and we're actually feeling this expression of life coming through us to ask the questions and say we really want to know, really want to be heard as well. And I also feel rather strongly listening, coming from a very holistic standpoint myself, that there's a tremendous amount of validity in the allopathic approach, and that we mustn't chuck out the baby with the bathwater. You know, I feel very sorry for doctors, and I'm sure that the medical fraternity present must feel a little bit what must be said to be the truth. But sometimes it's very appropriate to use the allopathic approach. What is right for my body in this moment? And it might actually be an antibiotic. So I feel, you know, we have to be very open and not to be careful not to get too out of balance, even on the other side.
I agree with that, I think at the same time you sometimes have to take an extreme position in order to get things changed at all. You have to play devil's advocate in some ways. I mean, personally I would never take an aspirin, but I think in some ways that's an extreme approach. And I'm quite open to other people feeling that taking aspirins is quite appropriate for them at times. But I do think that to get things changed, you have to be very clear about what the alternative is to exactly what's going on at the moment, and then eventually you come back to some kind of balance or middle point between the two that hopefully takes the best of both worlds.
Yes, I'd just like to take them a bit further and say, while I totally agree with the holistic approach, I very much approve of prevention rather than waiting until you're ill and then doing something about it. I've actually been a pharmacist since 1949, and I have seen acute lymphatic leukemia in children, for instance, go from a killer in 6 weeks to now there was an 85% cure. I've seen hypertension, if you like, you know, go from an absolute killer completely through to a little bit of blocker now, and you know, you can keep it down. And all these things, so I do think there is a pro for medicine, but as you have just subsequently said, in its favour, in moderate moderation.
I just, you know, when I asked the question about what we might do and sort of the days about the power of caring and about empowering people, implicit, you know, that the first ground rule, it appears, is taking control, which is, I think, what was being echoed time and time again this morning. Making decisions between allopathic medicine or a more holistic approach or complementary approach is about taking control, is about making decisions. And I think Don and Anna actually documented quite well those first 2 weeks from diagnosis to decision making and taking control. And so maybe this is an issue that is inherently wrapped up in what you're talking about as well.
I think so, yes. And I think a related aspect is to do with physician heal myself, and I think as therapists of whatever variety, we should be looking very much at our own lifestyle, at balancing our own lifestyle, at leading, you know, a healthy lifestyle, of dealing with our own emotions well, of thinking about our own life journey, and working on communicating well. You know, all those kinds of things are so crucial that we're working on those, so that we're not asking our clients to do something that we're not struggling with ourselves.
Are there any more questions before we finish for our
with the heat?
Coffee break? Yes, we have to balance it against this fundamental time. Sorry, what was something you were going to make?
Just one comment. I particularly appreciate your adding the fourth element to what's usually, but there's usually only three. People now talk about mind, body, and spirit, mm-hmm. and you've added environment to that. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, that becomes a very, very important point. I go further myself than just saying environment. When I think of environment, I still think of something quite separate from me, you know, those nasty bits of pollution and radiation and UV and things that are pouring down on my head these days. But I think everything exists in a context. And so it's like body, mind, spirit, and the context in which that sits. And there's an interaction between the larger context, including the environment, and what one can relate to specifically as a single individual. And of course, that whole context becomes the content of a larger context. There's something ultimately and intimately connected with much larger universal issues in this kind of consideration. But if one can just touch into that somehow, or help other people to become aware that they're not just isolated little creatures, health seems a natural, good health seems a natural part of that recognition.
Okay, if there are any more questions, I'm going to be doing my TV director bit. I've just hoped that, so that probably means 3 minutes. Or at least I hope it does. I'm sure you'd like to join me in saying a big thank you to Jill for putting across what I found a very confusing area so succinctly. Thank you, Jill. We're going to be starting again at 4 o'clock, running along. with the program, and that's Rita Silverflint.
Sitting my fingers crossed.
No. I'm sure she'll be here.